or not, we're starting. So let's pray, and while I'm praying, maybe some more folks will trickle in, and then we'll jump into Exodus. Lord, thank you for this morning. Again, we're thankful for all you are and all you do, and Lord, as we've thought this week of your grace and your gifts to us, we are we're amazed that you love us the way you do and provide for us the way you have and continue to. And but I'm even thankful for your word and for the opportunity we have to know you because of your word and through your word. And I pray that as we take this time this morning, that we would, as a group, take your word seriously, that we would desire to be different because of what we read here, what we understand here. I pray that you would plant your word deep in us and change us from the inside out as we live our lives, so we might be truly thankful in all things, as you call us to. Lord, thank you for our time together this morning, for the opportunity we have. We ask this in your name, amen. All right, we're in Exodus. We're in the section that's chapter 25 through chapter 31. We're working our way through the different pieces of furniture, different parts of the tabernacle, and we've made it now to, we looked at first of all, in this section, we started with chapter 26 and went and looked through the tent itself that would be the tabernacle. And then we started 2 weeks ago, we started on the furniture, and we made it through the ark and the mercy seat and the table of bread, or the table of the bread of the presence. I think King James calls the table of showbread. The idea is it represents and stands for the presence of God with the people of Israel. And so we made it through those two things, and today we find ourselves in chapter 25, verse 31, at the golden lampstand. The golden lampstand. It was an integral part of the holy place. Again, if you remember, we kind of described this a little bit, and I wish there was some way for me to figure out how to do a PowerPoint up here, but you're talking about me, so that's probably not going to happen. But if you were to imagine the tabernacle complex, if you will, there was an outer curtain, if you will, that separated all people from this place. On the outside of the tabernacle tent walls, the courtyard walls, anybody could be there. It could be anybody there, Jew, Gentile, sojourner, whatever. There was no reason that you couldn't be there. And so that was wide open territory, if you will. Once you walk through the main entrance into the courtyard, only Jewish people or those who had proselyted themselves to become Jews could be in that area. And it's not just a sojourner. So there's a difference between what was called a proselyte and what was called a sojourner. A proselyte is a Gentile who said, I will do everything that I can to accommodate, to be Jewish, to follow the law. I will, you know, the circumcision was part of it, following the dietary law was part of it, worshiping the one true God was part of it. That was what a proselyte was. And if you had taken those steps, you could never actually become a Jewish person, but you could become a proselyte and a follower of God, and actually participate in the congregation and with the congregation. We're going to see that term as we progress through the Pentateuch. We're going to see the term congregation a lot. But that, if you were part of the congregation, you were part of the part of Israel that was worshiping God as he displayed here in Genesis, in Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, Deuteronomy. That's what you were part of. So that was one thing. Now, there are also things called sojourners or strangers. Some translations call them sojourners. Some translations call them strangers. Those are people who lived in the area, in the land, but were not at all part of, they weren't worshiping God, they weren't proselyting, they were not in any way desiring to become a part of Israel or to worship with them. So those were strangers and sojourners, and so that's a difference. A sojourner could not go into the courtyard of the tabernacle. Beyond the courtyard then, only Levites, only priests could go past the courtyard into the holy place. There are three major divisions: courtyard, holy place. In the holy place, there are three pieces of furniture. Three pieces of furniture in the thing called the holy place. There is the table of the bread of the presence. There's the altar of incense, which we'll talk about later. And there is the golden candlestick. The golden candlestick is the only thing that provided light for the inside of the holy place. That's where the light came from. It was very important. Some say that this light was left burning 24 hours a day. That the oil that they would need to press to get ready for it, this oil was there and would burn 24 hours a day. Others suggest that the first course of priests to go in the morning would actually light the lampstand, and then it would go. I think history or tradition of the Jews actually says it burned 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It always burned, which is kind of the idea of why the festival of Hanukkah is important. Festival of Hanukkah was a situation in the intertestamental period, in that time period between the Old Testament Malachi and New Testament Matthew. There's about a 400-year gap there. In that time period, there's a great deal of upheaval in the land, and at one point, a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes is the Greek leader of that land, and he had actually set himself up as important and had burned 24 hours a day, 8 days, until they were able to get more oil in for the candlestick to be lit. So that's why Hanukkah is important. And so I think that leads to the idea that it was a 24-hour day burning in there. So the candlestick was what provided light. Once you got past the veil, there's one more section of the tabernacle called the Holy of Holies, or the Most Holy Place. And the Most Holy Place had no light source in it. So how does a high priest see to do the things he needs to do in there? It's the glory of God is in there. And you want to see light, that's going to be lighter than any light you've ever seen at all. So it was continually lit with the presence of God, but it was veiled from the other section. So that's why there didn't need to be a light source inside the Holy of Holies, because it was designed to be the presence of God would be the light of that area. So those are the furniture pieces that are there. So we're now at the golden lampstand. The golden lampstand is described in Exodus chapter 25, starting at 31 and going through the end of the chapter, verse 40. And it talks about how there are seven, let's just read it real quick. You shall make a lampstand of pure gold. Lampstand shall be made of hammered work. Its base, its stems, its cups, its calyxes, and its flower shall be of one piece with it. There will be six branches going out of its sides, and three branches of the lampstand out of one side, and three branches of the lampstand on the other side of it. Three cups made like almond blossoms, each with calyx and flower on one branch, and three cups made like almond blossoms, each with calyx and flower on the other branch. So for the six branches going out of the lampstand and on the lampstand itself, there shall be four cups made like almond blossoms with the calyx. So you've got a seven bowl menorah, right? So the lampstand that's in the temple and tabernacle doesn't look like the Hanukkah lampstand. Okay, just get that out of your head. It's not the same. They're not tied to each other in any way. The Hanukkah lampstand has eight because of 8 days, right? And it's not tied to the original lampstand, except for the fact that it's tied to the days that the lampstand burned in the temple without oil. Okay, that's what it's tied to. But it's not the same. This is the original that God designed. And it's designed so it's got seven bowls, three of one kind, four of another, and it would provide lamp. Provide light, provide lamp. It's made out of apparently one single piece of gold that is hammered out. It is solid gold of one piece hammered out. A lot of discussion what that word hammered out means. I would take it to mean hammered out. That's what I would take it to mean. I don't know why we have to argue about what hammered out means. Hammered out means hammered out. And so that's what we're going to take it to mean. So it would be a one piece of gold that the craftsmen, who we're going to meet later on, the craftsmen would have taken the time to hammer out and make and shape into this one piece. Because it's pure gold, we know that pure gold is extremely malleable, right? It's bendable, it's workable, and so it was worked into this beautiful lampstand. It is interesting that as of right now, in Jerusalem, there is a place called the Temple Museum. And if you go there, which we did not go there this last trip to Israel, we went there the trip before. If you go there, they'll tell you they have the furniture made, ready to go back in to temple when they get to build it on top of the Temple Mount. So they've gone through this Exodus section, they've looked at the description of it, and they have actually built. What I found very interesting is we were going through that tour, and the tour guide girl was talking about the stuff, and she gave none of the spiritual significance regarding any of the things she was talking about. So it was kind of disappointing with what they understand. For them, it seems, at least for the secular Jews, it's just furniture with no spiritual significance whatsoever. In fact, I don't think she didn't even say what the high priest's headband said. So I kind of told her what it said. So anyhow, it was a good trip. It was good. But they have furniture ready to go. So that's the candlestick. And it, like I said, it's important because it was the light for the holy place. This is what, if you recall, since we're getting to Christmas, we should at least talk about this. This is what Zacharias was working on when he was in the temple, in the holy place, when the angel appeared to him and said, "You're going to have a son." Zacharias was actually trimming the wicks on the golden lampstand. So it has significance regarding New Testament. Some have tried to say that, well, it's also got significance because Jesus said, "I'm the light of the world." But when Jesus said, "I'm the light of the world," he was celebrating Hanukkah. He was celebrating Hanukkah. He was not celebrating the golden lampstand. And that's why I told you they're different. They're different things. But it is still significant because it does symbolize the presence of God. Now, if you think of the first three things, the Ark of the Covenant with the mercy seat, the table of the bread of the presence, and the golden lampstand, really, I think all of those three things represent kind of God's presence with the people, if you think about it. God's light, what we know the table of the bread of the presence represents that because that's what it's called. It's called the table of the bread of the presence. The mercy seat and ark is where the presence of God actually was, and the candlestick, I believe, symbolizes the light that God provided for his people. So I think all three of the first three pieces of furniture, and I think that's why they're clumped together, because right here they all represent the presence of God with the people. So the first three pieces of furniture are really God's presence-focused pieces of furniture. The last three are all really significantly about man's responsibility. Man's responsibility to God and man's way to approach God. So all the first three, again, the first three all represent, I believe, God's presence with the people. The last three pieces of furniture represent the people's responsibility to God. And we'll walk through that as we go. So that's the golden lampstand. Sometimes it's called the candlestick, but that's what it is. A candlestick is really an improper translation of that word, because the candle wasn't invented. The candlestick idea wasn't invented until like the Dark Ages. So when Jesus day, in this day, there was no such thing as a candlestick, so it couldn't have meant that. But a lampstand is what it probably is more accurate. So it's a golden lampstand. The next three are again represent the people's responsibility to God, and they start off in chapter 27. Verse 1. So if you'll jump there, we get to the bronze altar. The bronze altar is found in chapter 27, verses 1 through 8. He says, "You shall make an altar of acacia wood. 5 cubits long and 5 cubits broad. The altar shall be square and its height shall be 3 cubits. So let's first of all get the size of the altar. It is not small. It is large. 5 cubits is 7.5 feet. Okay, if we're taking a cubit to mean what a cubit is, largely it's the length of a man's forearm from pinky to elbow, right at 18 inches. In most cases, most people, except for Ron, think that a cubit, he's not here, so I'm going to pick on him big time today. Most people think a cubit is 18 inches, 18 inches. So if you take 5 feet, multiply that 1.5, you get 7.5 feet. So it's 7.5 feet long, 7.5 feet wide, and it's 3 cubits tall, so it's 4.5 feet tall. It's not small. It is a big, big altar. In Lebanon, Pennsylvania, the Mennonite folks have actually built a tabernacle reproduction there, and they have it to scale. It's built to scale, and when I taught school there in Lewistown, we actually one of our field trips was to go over to Lebanon and to go into and look at that thing, and it is amazing. This, you know, in my mind I had what the size of the altar would be. And then you walk in the courtyard, and that altar is huge. It's massive, the size of that thing that is there. And so it was huge, first of all. What was it made of? It was made of acacia wood. Remember, acacia wood is the wood from Egypt that never rots. It's a very strong wood. This wood would need to be strong, because it is going to have fire real close to it all the time. Now, it's going to be overlaid with gold, but there's still going to be fire around it all the time. It says, you shall make horns for it on its four corners. Its horns shall be of one piece with it. So you've got this great big 7.5 by 7.5 by 4.5 foot tall square, and on each four corner that has a horn. A horn would be just a thing sticking out and up like a horn, not a trumpet kind of horn. This is a horn that would, I think, it was probably used to help keep animals and stuff where they needed to be. So anyway, the horns are there. And you overlay it with bronze. So can you imagine? I can't. How huge this thing was, overlaid with bronze, and there were some Levites who their job was to carry this thing around from place to place. And they don't know it yet. They don't know it yet, but these Levites are going to carry that thing for 40 years. Every time God says move, they're going to have to pick that thing up and carry it. It had to have weighed just an incredible amount of weight. I can't imagine. Acacia wood, first of all, which is a very hard wood, overlaid with bronze, that huge thing would be carried every time. Now, it should have been carried for 11 days and then put where it's supposed to go. But it was carried for 40 years and then actually ended up at Shiloh and stayed there for a little bit. So I can't fathom how heavy it was and how hard it was going to be to carry this thing. But he didn't just give examples of how to make the altar. He also talks about the utensils that go with it. He says you'll make pots for it and to receive its ashes, and shovels and basins and forks and fire pans. You shall make all of its utensils as bronze. So not only are all of the pots and all is the altar covered over in bronze, but everything, all the utensils for it are also made with bronze. You also will make a grating, a network of bronze, and on the net you shall make 4 bronze rings at its 4 corners. So now you got this huge grate. It's actually, if you think about it, it's the first barbecue. It really is. That's what he's making here. He's making a Weber grill. So if you want the best way to grill something, you ought to go back to the altar, because that's what they used it for. And that really is what they used it for, by the way. They did really use it for that. A lot of it was all burned up, but the priests' food came from that altar. They would get a hook and they would take their portion off of that altar. And it was very specific. They were supposed to take the food off of the altar while it was cooked on the altar. There are two guys, Eli's sons, who chose to do it that way. They would boil meat and stick their hook in. What's the difference between boiled meat and barbecued meat? Barbecue's much better, but boiled meat comes off the bone a lot easier, right? You boil meat, and if you boil it long enough, it falls off the bone. So when Eli's sons were sticking their hook into boiled meat and pulling out, they were pulling out more of a portion than they should have gotten. And that's why they get judged. It's not because they pulled meat. They were allowed meat. They were pulling more than they were supposed to. They were basically being gluttonous hogs and pulling too much meat. So interesting. That's a side story we'll never get to, because that's in Samuel. We're going to be good to make it to Deuteronomy in some years. So they got that. Then you got, you shall make under its ledge the altar. They got the grating. And then you make poles out of acacia woods, overlay with them with bronze. And the poles go inside the altar, and then it's to be carried wherever they go. Now he does say to give them a little bit of a break. He says, "You shall make it hollow with boards, as it had been shown you on the mountain, so it shall be made." So it isn't solid acacia wood. It's kind of a frame of hollow acacia wood, but it's still, if you overlay that with bronze, that big of a thing, one piece, that's going to weigh a lot, and it's going to be carried around, the wilderness for 40 years. So that's the bronze altar. Now we're going to jump to chapter 30. Yes. The altar itself is going to be built up, but the altar, just the piece of furniture itself, is 3 cubits tall. So that's 4.5 feet. They built ramps to get everything up there. They built ramps up there. And we'll get to that as we get to the priest's garments, actually. One of the big deals with the priest's garments is how they were made so that the nakedness of the high priest wouldn't get, or the priest wouldn't get uncovered as he was. It's like, you know, ladies and steps. It was covered that way. So, but we'll get to that. They were hauling bulls and stuff up to get on that altar. Yes, they absolutely were. And it is, when you see it actually on its, I would encourage you, if you ever get a chance, if you're ever back in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, or I guess it's Lancaster. It's either Lebanon or Lancaster. I think it's Lancaster. If you're ever there, it's all the same area. Lebanon, Lancaster, all that are in the same basic area. But if you ever get a chance to do it, I would highly recommend going into the it's a Mennonite thing, and it is a tabernacle. It's a full-scale tabernacle deal. And the altar, it when it's up on its thing, it is like 1.5 feet taller than I am. It's huge. It's huge. So it would have been, there would have been effort in doing sacrifice. Absolutely. I don't know that it was supposed to be easy. So, good question. Any other questions? I'm just kind of flying through here, and I shouldn't probably do that. I should let you have a chance to ask questions. Okay, no hands. Good. Here we go. You don't have to think of one. When I say that, you don't actually have to think of one. If you don't have one, let it go, and we'll move forward. Next is the altar of incense. Altar of incense was placed inside the holy place, not the Holy of Holies, but inside the holy place. So if you're a priest, and I'm gonna turn my back on you just for a second so that I can walk in with you, and we're walking into the holy place, all right? On the right-hand side would be the table of bread, the bread of the presence, and it would have the 12 loaves of bread on it. On the left-hand side as you go in is the candlestick, or the, I shouldn't call it that, the lampstand. And then straight ahead of you, before you get to the veil, is the altar of incense, right? And the altar of incense, we're going to get how the spices are made. It's a very specific spice mix that's made for that, and it was burned, and what it did was it represented the prayers of the people, It represented their reaching out or speaking to or going to God. Not him to them, but them to him is what it represents. So let's just read about it. You shall make an altar on which to burn incense. You'll make it of acacia wood. A cubit shall be its length, a cubit its breadth. It shall be square, and 2 cubits shall be its height. So it is 1.5 by 1.5. So it's not a huge piece of furniture. 1.5 by 1.5 by 4.5. 4.5 feet tall, 3 cubits, right? No, 2 cubits. So it's only 3 feet tall, okay? Its horn shall be of 1 piece with it. So it's going to have horns on it as well. Overlaid with pure gold, its tops and around its sides and its horns, and you shall make it molding of gold around it. So it's going to be acacia wood overlaid with gold, with golden rings. And Aaron shall, let's go to verse 7, Aaron shall burn fragrant incense on it. Every morning when he dresses the lamps, he shall burn it. And when Aaron sets up the lamps at twilight, he shall burn it. A regular incense offering before the Lord throughout your generations. You shall not offer unauthorized incense on it. So this is very specific, and we actually have an instance not too far away from here where there are 2 of Aaron's sons called Nadab and Abihu who are going to burn strange incense on the altar of incense, and they are going to be judged for it. They're going to be judged for it. It's very specific what they're supposed to be offered here and what is supposed to be represented here. It's not their own. I know when I went to Bible college, it was Nadab and Abihu judged because they were drunk when they offered incense. I don't know if that's the case. I think they offered strange fire and offering something that wasn't approved as far as incense goes. It was only to represent the prayers of the people. So now if you read like I do, wait a second. Brian, you just said you thought the lamps burned 24 hours a day. The lamp burned 24 hours a day. And yet it says here, when Abraham lights the tent, lights the lights at twilight, what's going on there? Well, so I believe that's when the tabernacle set up. Remember, the tabernacle had to be carried from place to place, right? It was a movable tent. And so as they carried it, the lampstand wasn't burning. Okay, it wasn't. They weren't carrying the lampstand with it on fire. They would have to put it out to carry it. So when they got the tabernacle set up, when twilight hit is when Aaron would go in or the priest would go in and light the lamp. And it would stay lit burning until it got moved again. It got moved again. But every morning they would go in and they would trim the wicks for the next day's burning. So that's how I think that's explained and why I think it's still burning 24 hours a day all the time. So that's the altar of incense. And it was a specific spice, and we'll get to that in a little bit. Then the last thing is the bronze basin. This is the last piece of furniture, bronze basin, which is found in chapter 30, verses 17 through 21. I'll just read quickly. The Lord said to Moses, "You shall also make a basin of bronze with its stand of bronze for washing. You shall put it between the tent of meeting and the altar, and you shall put water in it, with which Aaron and his son shall wash their hands and their feet when they go into the tent of meeting or when they come near the altar to minister to burn food on the offering to the Lord. They shall wash with water so they may not die. They shall wash their hands and their feet that they may not die. It shall be a statute forever to them, even to him and to his offspring throughout their generations." So the last piece of furniture is the bronze basin. Some people call it the bronze laver. It is a huge bowl. It's a huge sink, if you will, that was full of water, and so as you're going into the, as you're walking into the courtyard, your first thing you see is this huge altar. Go around the altar, and right behind the altar is, in between the altar and the entrance to the holy place, is the bronze basin. So, and it was only for Aaron and the priests. It was only for the priests. General Joe Person never touched the laver, never touched the basin. He didn't clean himself. This was only for the priests. And what they had to do was go through a series of ceremonial cleansings as they approached to serve. If they were going to do sacrifice on the altar, they had to wash first and go up and do the sacrifice on the altar. If they were going to go into the holy place and do service there, they had to wash before they went in. And there were a series of ritual washings that had to happen to show the cleansing. Again, I believe that represents the responsibility of the people to be clean as they were doing service. I think that's what's going on. So the last three, the bronze altar, the altar of incense, and the bronze basin, I think all represent the responsibility or the response of the people to God. So the first three, God to them, the last three, them to him. And I think that's a pattern you're going to see throughout God's response or God's calling to Israel and working with them as a nation. There's always his responsibility to them, and there's always their responsibility to him, found together and married together in one way to worship. And I think that's the significance of those pieces of furniture that are there. So those are the pieces of furniture in the tabernacle, basically six. Some people say seven because they call the veil a piece of furniture. I think it's one of the curtains that's already been described. Some people say seven because they distinguish between the ark and the mercy seat. I don't, because they're designed to be together all the time. There's never a place where the mercy seat would be by itself and the ark would be by itself. In fact, they were even carried together. They were carried together as one piece all the time. I think it's also important to remember that what we're seeing here is merely a shadow of the real one in heaven. Okay? This, we get in our head that, yeah, this is the real thing that is, you know, that somehow has symbolized something that's mystical. No, that's not the case. And we say that not because we're making it up. We say it because Hebrews tells us that. In Hebrews 9, it says that the thing, this tabernacle that Moses got was merely a shadow of the real one in heaven. And it's important that there's a real one in heaven. It really is important there's a real one in heaven. Because if it's just this one, who did this tabernacle accomplish atonement for? For all people? Just the Jews. Just the Jews. Remember, if you're a Gentile, not a proselyte, you are excluded from all of this. You're out. Because once that you hit that entrance to the courtyard, you can't go in. You can't go in. And if Jesus is a high priest for the Jews, and he sprinkles blood on the mercy seat for the Jews, then who has he accomplished reconciliation and atonement for? The Jews. But what's really interesting, according to Hebrews, is Jesus is not a high priest after the order of Aaron. He's a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek was priest to the Most High God for all people. I think it's significant that Abraham offered to Melchizedek offerings. And it's not that I think it's important, it's that God thinks it's important, because in Hebrews it tells us about this. So that when Jesus entered the holy place, Holy of Holies, most holy place, to sprinkle his blood on the mercy seat in heaven, he did it for all people, not just the Jews. It's really significant that there's a mercy seat that's not just this one here. Because if it's just this one here, then we are hopeless. We as Gentiles are hopeless people unless we proselyte ourselves and become Jews. And there is a movement. There is a movement that's gaining steam out there right now that says if you're a Gentile and you want to be a believer, you have to become a Jew. It's gaining steam. It's called Teshuvah. If you ever have somebody come to your door and they want to talk to you about Teshuvah, just say, no, thank you. I sneezed yesterday. You don't need to do that. Because it's adding to grace the law. It is Galatians on steroids. That's what it is. And it is, I believe, it is wrong. I believe it's heresy. I'll just go out and say it. It is heretical because of the teaching of the New Testament that says, no, you don't have to do that as a Gentile. Be confident in this. Acts chapter 15 answers the question by the apostles in the early church. It was, what do we do with these Gentiles? Because, and I'm sure we'll get there when we get there on Sunday morning with Mike, what do you do? I mean, here you have all of the church up until Acts 10, the whole church, maybe nine-ish, is Jewish. And so it would make sense. If you're a Jewish person, you go on keeping the law. I don't think they have to. In fact, I know they don't have to because of what Paul says in Galatians. But then you have these Gentiles that are being brought in. And it's, what do you do with Gentiles? Do we tell them to keep the law or do we not tell them to keep the law? And you know, Acts 15 is the letter written by James, the brother of Jesus, who says, here's what you do. You don't keep the law, Gentiles. Abstain from fornication. Don't eat meat offered to idols. That's it. That's for the Gentile. Galatians, Paul is really clear. Are you really going to go back to a different gospel, having started with grace? You're going to go back to the law? How does that happen? That makes no sense. So it's really clear that it's not by keeping of the law, Galatians, therefore by the deeds of the law, no flesh will be justified. There's no way to justify yourself by keeping the law, even if it's in addition to grace. If you add anything to grace, what is it no longer? It's no longer grace. It's a wage. Okay, let's extrapolate then. If it's a wage, then it's a payment for works. Right? What does Isaiah say about our works? They're like filthy rags. They're sinfully filthy rags. What does Romans say about the wages for sin? Death. So if we make it wages for our works, which are sinful, it's death. The only way to be right with God is through grace. It's through grace offered through Jesus on the cross for those of us who don't deserve it, with his blood sprinkled on the mercy seat. Not this mercy seat, but the one in heaven. The one in heaven. That's really significant. So that is the furniture. And any questions, comments, statements about furniture? And we're moving on if there's not. All right. Next is... I got one.
Why was that altar so hot? I mean, what was it up on and why?
It was up on a stand, and I think it was high for two reasons. Symbolically, I think it was high so that the smoke could be seen throughout the whole congregation. Okay, because again, you've got 2 million people. Not everybody's inside, right? You got a little tabernacle. You've got 2 million people. Everybody can't be in there to watch this going on, right? There's a wall. And so I think it's high so that when the smoke gets burned on there, it goes up high enough that the people can see sacrifices going on. I think that's one reason. Second reason is because of all the ash and stuff that had to be taken out underneath it. It was so that the priests had access, or the Levites actually, who would be doing this. The Levites had access to go in underneath the altar, get all the junk out, take it outside the camp and throw it up without having to try to lift that altar up. You know, so I think that's what, it would naturally fall down underneath and then be able to get the pans out and go do that. And if you considered how much stuff's going to get burned on this altar, there's a lot of stuff getting burned every day. And then when you hit Passover or some of those sacrifice days, it's amazing when you just think of, if you go down the list, when it gets dedicated, when the tabernacle itself gets dedicated, just look at the stuff that was sacrificed that day. We're going to get there. We're going to get there 20 years from now, but we're going to get there and talk about that. But there's this huge sacrifice that was done that day of all this stuff burned because there's a huge feast. They burned it, they offered it as a sacrifice, and then they had a feast that day. And so I think that's the second reason it was up so high, was to make it easier to get the ashes and stuff out of it, out from underneath it, because it couldn't just pile up there. Good question. Any others? Okay, moving on. The next section, if you will, is I call it the court of the tabernacle. And it's in 27, verses 9 through 19. It talks about the court. Oh, nope, I should go back to the, there's another section actually for the lampstand, and that's where the oil is described, making people mad. You know, when you do that, people get up and walk out on you. I don't know why that is. I made a mistake. Sorry, guys. For the golden lampstand, we actually should include chapter 27, verses 20 through 21, which is the oil that was used for the lampstand. It's very specific. You shall command the people of Israel that they bring you pure beaten olive oil for the light, that a lamp may regularly be set up to burn in the tent of meeting outside the veil that is before the testimony. Aaron and his son shall tend it from evening to morning before the Lord. It shall be a statute forever to be observed throughout their generations by people of Israel. So there's the oil is supposed to be pure olive oil that is beaten, not just pressed. And again, here's, if you ever get a chance to go to Israel, one of the places you go is the city of Nazareth. And in Nazareth, they have, and we do this every time, so I'm pretty sure the next time we'll actually go here. Nazareth, most of Nazareth is Palestinian controlled, which, and you can tell. When you go into a Palestinian controlled city, you can tell. But in one little area in Nazareth, there is this really special place that's run by Coptic Christians. And it is a recreation of first century Nazareth. They have a first century recreation of a first century synagogue there. They have a recreation of a first century olive press there, where they're pressing olives. And as you walk through there, they'll tell you what like extra virgin olive oil is. I guess there's this thing as virgin olive oil. Then there's regular old olive oil. Then there's the junk olive oil. And they talk through how they get all that stuff and how it all gets mixed with water and all that kind of stuff as it degrades into the different kinds of pressings. This is to be the first pressing only. The oil that was used for the light in the candlestick was first pressing oil. And it was actually oil that was beaten by the people, not even pressed necessarily. And so it was a special, very, very pure olive oil that was used to burn in those things. And that olive oil is going to be used for lots of things. That pure olive oil is going to be mixed with some spices, and it's going to be used to anoint Aaron and his sons. It's going to be that pure olive oil is really significant in the worship of God. And there are, if you ask 100 theologians the significance of olive oil, you'll get 100 answers. Okay? I don't know why it's significant. I think olives were abundant in that area. I mean, just go and look at all the olive trees. You'll pass olive trees all over the place. They're just all over the place there. And olive trees grow forever. It's likely. When you go to Israel, I'm saying when now because you really need to go. When you go to Israel and you're walking through the Garden of Gethsemane, and you see potentially 2,000-year-old olive trees, that potentially Jesus prayed at the foot of one of those olive trees, they're still there. Those olive trees are still there. Now you'd think, huge! No, because olive trees are gnarly little things. They are nasty-looking trees, but they produce olives all the time.
It's kind of like man's works are being burnt up.
Exactly. That could very well be that the olive oil it does represent it's pure because it was that first beating pressing stuff. It was to be pure olive oil, and it may represent because it's used for all different kinds of stuff. It's a very significant thing. So very special olive oil. I think it was used because it was abundant. Olives were abundant in the land. They could get it basically whenever they needed to get it. They could make some if they needed to make some. And it was, again, it was something that they could guarantee the purity of because they're making it themselves. It's not like crude oil coming out of the ground that they're anointing people. It's not even like corn oil or vegetable. It was pure, absolutely pure olive oil that they used for the lamps. I actually read some guy that suggested, well, that because it was pure, it would burn longer. Maybe. I don't know. I've never tested. I've never done a scientific test on whether extra virgin olive oil burns longer than regular. I don't know that answer. So, anyhow. So that gets us through the furniture. That's a good place to stop. That gets us through the furniture, and it is 9:45, so it's a good time to stop. Next, we'll move through the last. We'll next week. Again, because it's Journey to Judea, there'll be no Sunday school hour, so please don't show up at 9. Ron's not here. Somebody tell Ron so that he doesn't show up at 9. I'll try to make an announcement here this morning, too. So next week, there's no Sunday school hour because of Journey to Judea. We'll pick it back up on the 10th with the courtyard, and then we're going to spend a lot of time on the priests. There's a large section of this area that's devoted to the priests and priesthood, their clothing and all that kind of stuff, and we'll spend some time on that as well because it becomes significant. So let me pray, and then we'll let you guys go. Lord, thank you for today. Thank you for your word. Thank you for reaching, making a way for us to come and approach you through your Son, Jesus Christ. Thank you for his blood being sprinkled on the mercy seat, which provides for us redemption and hope and justification and all those things. Thank you for your love for us. We ask this in your name. Amen. You're dismissed. Thank you.